Data Governance and Protection Standard of India, or DGPSI. This is supposed to be the pathbreaker when it comes to compliance with privacy and AI legislation, especially in context of India, as India has passed the DPDP. Now, there are various ways in which you can comply with the law, but managing or putting an effective data governance program is key. And what better than having a data governance and protection standard which allows you to do it in a standardized way that is recommended by experts. This is what the DGPSI, or the Data Governance and Protection Standard of India, does. And we're going to talk to none other than the brain behind it and also the thought leader and pioneer in India's privacy landscape. I'm talking about none other than Vijay Shankar Nagaraja Rao, who's commonly known as Navi. Navi has agreed to be with us and share his views. And not only that, he's also agreed that if you have any questions, put those questions in comments. We will take those questions and do a new episode and clarify all those questions you have. So take this opportunity, write down your questions in comments, make posts on LinkedIn, whichever way, and tag me. And the more questions you ask, the sooner we get Navi back. But for now, let's go and talk to him about how has India's privacy landscape emerged? What will happen in context of the AI? Will there be a new law or not? And also this DGPSI, as well as his organization called FDPPI. And as this episode comes around the Data Protection Day, that is January 27th, I encourage you to watch this and learn from Navi. And if you need help in your data protection activities, do not hesitate to contact us. Thank you so much, and let's go and talk to Navi.
Hello, and welcome to the Fit for Privacy podcast with Punit Bhatia. This is the podcast for those who care about their privacy. Here, your host, Punit Bhatia, has conversations with industry leaders about their perspectives, ideas, and opinions relating to privacy, data protection, and related matters. Be aware that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are not legal advice. Let us get started.
So here we are with Navi. Navi, welcome to Fit for Privacy podcast. It's such a privilege and honor to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Navi. So you have done so many things, and you've been such influence over the Indian privacy landscape, if I may call it like that, for last so many decades. Can you kind of describe to us how has your journey been and what is currently the privacy landscape? Because people confuse, think that now the DPDP has come in and hence India has a privacy law. While most knowledgeable people like you know that it is not the case. We have a formal data protection law, but privacy was embedded, enshrined in the constitution and even otherwise in many other laws for last so many decades. So can you walk us through combining your journey and the Indian privacy landscape, because both have almost been very, very similar, if I may call it.
Yeah. See, all cyber law related discussions in India started with the Information Technology Act. The discussions started in 1998 when a draft law was passed in India based on the UNCITRAL model law. As you know, that law was basically meant for e-commerce promotion. But in the process of designing a law, some aspects of cyber crimes were involved. It was included in that. So this was the year 1998 up to 2000. India has been discussing privacy as a human right through the Supreme Court decisions, because our constitution did not have a special mention of privacy. But right from 1954, in a particular case called the MP Sharma case, the discussion started. But MP Sharma case actually said that privacy is not a fundamental right. But that remained as a Supreme Court decision. It was an 8-member judgment. Then subsequently, in the 60s, there were other decisions, starting from Karak Singh case, where physical privacy was recognized by the Supreme Court as a part of the fundamental rights. Okay. That was basically cases where police were trying to make searches at the residence of a person, and the court felt that home is the castle kind of thing, and said that there is a privacy which is part of the life and liberty. But still, because of this MP Sharma case, there was always a thinking that India doesn't have a privacy right recognized as a fundamental right. So coming to the legislation, way back in 2006, the government actually tried to make a law and created a draft bill which was called Personal Data Protection Bill. This was actually presented in the parliament simultaneously with the Information Technology Amendment Act 2006. And this Information Technology Amendment Act got passed, that became the ITAA 2008, and in 2019 it was notified. And in that amendment, there were specific sections on protection of personal data and sensitive personal data. This section, which people must have heard, 43 capital A, came with this amendment in 2008. And the rules notified under 43 capital A in 2011 was a complete guideline on how companies should handle a sensitive personal data. That is the reasonable security practices they have to practice, which included obtaining the consent, issuing a privacy policy, which should be with a notice, and then data minimization, data retention minimization, cross-border transfer. All these aspects were part of Section 43 capital A rules notified in April 2011. There was also 72 capital A, which talked about contractual obligations involving protection of privacy and the consequences of an organization violating a contractual obligation regarding handling of personal information. This section 72A is relevant even today, because after this DPDPA 2023 became a law, 43 capital A was deleted from IDA 2000, but 72 capital A has not been deleted. So there is still a residual part of personal data protection which remains in Information Technology Act. And it is for this reason we consider that DPDPA is a continuation of Information Technology Act 2000, which means that by legislation, privacy right protection applicable to information privacy has been in existence from this ITA amendment of 2008. However, when Puttaswamy judgment was given by the Supreme Court, which was only in 2017, there was a formal recognition from the Supreme Court that MP Sharma judgment was to be rejected, and we should recognize privacy as a fundamental right linked to Article 21 of our Constitution as a part of life and liberty. So, but still the Puttaswamy judgment basically worked under the principle that information privacy is important because there is a digitization in India, and infringement of privacy in electronic form is much more easy. These were the same arguments which in USA brought in the HIPAA Act in 1996. Okay, similar arguments were made by the judges in the Puttaswamy case, and therefore they ended up declaring that privacy is a fundamental right, but they did not define what was privacy. So the question of how to handle that situation was confronting the government, and this DPDPA, which is present in the current form, addresses the situation where Supreme Court has focused more on information privacy. So the government has now decided, okay, let us do something about legislation regarding the information privacy and ensure that the organizations which are processing personal information, let us regulate that and bring in some kind of a discipline. So that is how this act, which is called Digital Personal Data Protection Act, this is not called as Privacy Protection Act, okay? Digital Personal Data Protection Act currently talks about the obligations of the data fiduciaries. The word data fiduciary itself is a great concept compared to the word data controller used in GDPR, because within that word lies the responsibility of a otherwise data controller as a trustee of the data principle. So therefore, though the act does not say this is a Privacy Protection Act, this is only a Data Protection Act, because the person who is expected to protect the personal data is a trustee, fiduciary, the responsibility for the privacy protection, I think, is to be recognized as a underlying principle in this particular act. I think this is what I look at as the journey of India from a time when Supreme Court started recognizing the non-existence of privacy right in MP Sharma to existence of physical privacy in Karak Singh case and other cases, but subsequently focusing on the concept of information privacy as the main risk to be contended with. And the government responded to this criteria by bringing in this DPDPA 2023.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you make a very clear distinction between India's Digital Personal Data Protection Bill being the digital data, while the EU General Data Protection talking about general data, so it's both personal and physical and all other forms of data. So that's very interesting. But I also have seen that in the DPDP, they don't talk about sensitive data, which was the case in the IT Act. Do you have a view on or opinion on that?
See, ITA 2000 has been a data-centric law, okay? So they use the word sensitive data. Now what has happened is, this particular act is looking at the organization which is processing the data as the object of this particular regulation. So they may look at defining a significant data fiduciary. At that time, they will take into account whether a data fiduciary is processing a sensitive personal data or ordinary data. So instead of defining data as sensitive and non-sensitive, and then say that whoever is handling sensitive personal data will be having additional obligations, responsibilities, what this act may try to do is, we will focus on the organizations and we will distinguish organizations which carry higher risk to privacy for various reasons. We will define them as significant data fiduciaries who will have this additional responsibilities like the DPO, DPIA, data audit, and other things. So I think the same objective may be perhaps achieved by a different means, by shifting the focus to classification of the data fiduciaries rather than classification of the data.
So that's interesting. So in your opinion, the sensitive data or sensitive personal data objective will be achieved by classifying the data fiduciary as significant. So all hospitals or healthcare companies would be classified like that, assumingly, and many others. And then you'll achieve the same objective in the end, but without burdening the usual companies with the responsibility of having to segregate data into sensitive personal data and personal data. So that will be very interesting if it happens in time. Now, the DPDP is here, and already we are talking about this there's slight talk last few weeks back, there was a talk about Artificial Intelligence Act also, because one of the ministers talked about. So is there something being contemplated on artificial intelligence also?
See, because this act, DPDPA, focuses on digital personal data, it is automatically taking into account the what GDPR calls as automated processing, because all data covered by DPDPA is automated processed. Okay, without the use of a computer, it doesn't become a digital data. Therefore, use of computer is there. Now, the computer, whether is used at the base level, where a programmer says something for the computer to do and that executes, which is the, let's say, base level of programming, which all computers do. Or the software is sophisticated enough to be classified as an artificial intelligence. Say, ultimately, artificial intelligence is also software. Okay, the instructions are given. The instructions include instructions to correct the code based on the observations. It is like a lathe or something like that, which has a sensor, and based on the sensor input, the lathe may get adjusted in terms of its position and other things. So that we don't formally recognize as artificial intelligence. It is a simple techno, software issue kind of a thing. So we feel that the requirement of artificial intelligence to some extent is already there in Indian law, because what Information Technology Act did was they introduced one very neglected section called Section 11, where they said that the activity of a system which gives out an automated decision is attributed to the person who causes that device to behave in the particular fashion, which means that the owner of the software is responsible for the action of the software. This is embedded in Information Technology Act as if it is a part of the contract regulation. Because of that, if there is an AI algorithm and it does some automated decision making, the responsibility and accountability for that automatically lies with the owner of the AI algorithm. Now, owner of the AI algorithm, you may call as the licensee, or if the licensor has not properly disclosed the default functioning, I say that the licensor should take the responsibility because he has not disclosed all the activities of the software. But anyway, there is a human who is the owner of the AI algorithm, whom Indian law today can recognize as the person responsible for the end action of an artificial intelligence algorithm. Okay, maybe the next question is, do we consider artificial intelligence as a juridical person? Okay, yeah. See, when we see courts, sometimes even others say that law should be more specific, so you give more and more clarification. So what I am talking of is like an interpretation of one innocuous Section 11 and extending it to the world of artificial intelligence, which was not there in the year 2000 or 1998 when this Section 11 was actually thought of. Okay, but because of the generic usage of the language, I am saying that today I can stand in a court and argue that Section 11 says that automated decision making is attributable to the owner. Therefore, a deep fake or any other artificial intelligence algorithm, you should attribute it to the owner. Therefore, the owner has to have due diligence. You see, I can also extend the concept of due diligence and concept of intermediary to this AI algorithm. I can consider the AI algorithm as an intermediary and the owner as the person who is giving instructions or passing the message. Therefore, he has to exercise due diligence. If he does not exercise due diligence, then the consequences, he may be even accountable personally. So, Information Technology Act is so designed that many of these modern day problems we can find solutions. But if the government thinks that worldwide we are building some ethics for AI, it is fine. I am fine with that. Basically, I focus on accountability.
Yeah.
The moment you say a particular AI can be properly accounted for and you bring it under legislation, then the normal ethical behavior of any organization fits into that. It may not be possible for us to define 100 cyber crimes saying that if AI does this, it's one punishment, this is 2 years, it's punishment kind of a thing. That is the old model of lawmaking, which our people say Income Tax Act in India actually adopted, and that's why it became very bulky. But if the law is made on principles, then we don't require a very huge set of laws. Okay. Now, even if you look at the EU law, basically it tries to classify the AI in based on the risks. Okay. And then tries to say some can be banned, some may be regulated, some can be free. In fact, EU, this thing may say that deepfake is not really a very risky AI. Whereas in India, I don't know, in the current scenario, deepfake may be the first thing to be regulated, okay? Which actually has to be based on the accountability. We are saying that the publishing organization, which is a YouTube or something, should be able to identify the origin of a particular video. Similar to what we have been talking of WhatsApp being able to identify the origin of a particular message. And therefore, there is accountability. See, after that, if a deepfake causes any kind of a defamation or something, then we know whom to ask for explanation. And courts are there to consider whether it's actually defamation or it is satire, whatever way. And courts can take their view. But if you do not know who is the person who is accountable, then Indian courts will find it difficult, particularly criminal offenses. Our criminal jurisprudence does not allow cases to be built up if you cannot identify the particular person who has committed the offense. In those cases, we have to ask the intermediary to take vicarious liability. Information Technology Act has got vicarious liability also. So we can say the organization will be deemed as the perpetrator of the crime unless they are able to tell us that some XYZ customer of their platform was the person who is responsible. So in a way, Indian law is robust enough to use the current law to meet some of these requirements. And let us see if government still wants to come up with the EU AI Act kind of a thing. It is welcome as long as it does not give some kind of a loophole. For example, you take the humanoid robots. Today, humanoid robot is allowed to be a CEO of a company. Okay. Now, if it takes a wrong decision and some adverse impact is there on an individual, the question is who has to be held responsible? So there, the EU law, the US law may have to define the juridical entity and treat that as a responsible. But if you do that, then you cannot put that AI robot in jail. You cannot give a death sentence to a humanoid robot, which may cause murder. Okay. But if you recognize the human behind that as the person who is accountable, then under the concept of due diligence, up to a particular point, you can protect that person against any, very high level of, say, punishments. But if it becomes necessary, if terrorists start using humanoid robots and commit, terrorist activities, our law, which recognizes the person behind the automated activity, can be convicted even for death sentence. Okay. Whereas if you define the AI algorithm or the robo as a juridical entity, you can only punish that. At best, you can deactivate it and dismantle it, nothing more than that. So I think defining AI as a juridical entity will actually dilute the provisions. That is my current view. So when the government comes up with an act, we have to see whether they will be innovative enough to take this kind of concepts in mind, or they will just go by the international order, just as people used to say GDPR is a golden standard, so India has to follow that. But India did not do that. India had tried to do something on their own. So similarly, this artificial intelligence law, when India adopts, they should look at it independently, not being tied down to, say, the EU draft.
Yeah, okay. No problem. I think I've shared your view. And in fact, India, I think, is part of the OECD group where they agreed on a principle-based approach for AI. And there is an AI framework at OECD level, which all member states have agreed to comply with. And underneath it, the subsequent legislation will come. But whether we talk about AI or privacy, there's one important term or one important way in which companies will need to manage. Of course, we still need to define who the jurisdiction is and who is the entity who is executing it or going to be taken into accountability. But still, that's called data governance, because end of the day, whether it's AI, whether it's privacy, it's about data. And when I last spoke to you, you were talking about this data governance framework that you have put in. And can you enlighten us about what is this data governance framework? How can it help? And how can people access it? Because it sounded like, or it seemed like to me, a very powerful tool which can enable, just like the ISO standards, which can enable companies to execute or manage data privacy or data rather, not privacy only, entire set of data in a very effective and responsible way.
See, we have called it as Data Governance and Protection Standard of India, or DGPSI. Mm-hmm. What drove us to work on this was that if an Indian entity, because this law is directed towards data fiduciaries, so data fiduciaries need to be compliant. Now, for compliance, and also our law has recognized the need for a profession called data auditor. Now, so tomorrow there should be a data auditor who is willing to actually evaluate the system of data management in an organization and then say whether this is compliant with the PDPA 2023 or not. So this requirement meant that companies need a proper framework for being in compliance with IT, this particular law, and help them during implementation. And then perhaps even to invite a third party auditor to certify. Okay. So if you look around the available framework, we had ISO 27001 for ISMS systems, which was for security, confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information. Whether that information is personal or non-personal, still 27001 would be applicable. And in the 2022 version, maybe they might have used some words related to privacy. But 27701, which was specifically created for GDPR compliance, but GDPR is not the same as DPDPA, so you cannot adopt 27701 for DPDPA 2023 compliance. Therefore, we needed a particular framework exclusively for DPDPA 2023 compliance. And additionally, there is a BIS standard in India which talks about data privacy for, you can say, data managers. See, assuming that data management in a corporate world focuses on value, okay, of data, that is enhancing the value of data for the shareholders' benefit, so a productivity of data. So in a data-governed organization, data is to be looked at as an asset, and everything should be done to see that the asset is more productive. Okay, so the BIS, the Bureau of Indian Standards, has created a particular standard for data governance. Within that, they have added one module with about 25 controls. We can call it as controls, though they call it as expected outcomes there. Okay, so 25 controls were directed towards data privacy. So what we felt was that from the beginning, say this DGPSI evolved from the earlier version called PDPSI, that is Personal Data Protection Standard of India, when about 2-3 years back. Okay, at that time itself, we had said that data is an asset, it has to be valued, and the value of data should be visible in a corporate environment. Otherwise, you cannot have adequate funding. The top management will not be able to provide support. So because of these things, we had included a lot of governance issues already in our PDPSI framework. So therefore, this time what we did was, we took DPDPA 2023 and we recognized that ITA 2000 still is relevant. So there are several aspects of ITA 2000 which has to be added to this governance model. And then this pure governance, whatever this BIS has said, we combined all these things and created this DGPSI as a framework, which today is a superset. It is simpler. Actually, it has only 50 controls. Okay, we call it as model implementation specifications. As against 200 plus controls, if you add various other things. So it is simple, but it covers the requirements of legal compliance of two acts, DPDPA and ITA 2000, and the governance requirements under the BIS. And I hope this will be very, very useful for organizations. We have also taken another thought into consideration that there is a system of assessment which is going on from a quality perspective or something like that. And we wanted to say that when an auditor does a thorough evaluation of controls, he also gets an idea about assessment. So therefore, we said that the system called Data Trust Score can be integrated with this certifiable audit system. And therefore, DGPSI becomes both an implementation framework, a third-party certifiable audit framework, and a third-party assessment framework. We feel that with this, the number of compliances which organizations need to work on will be reduced. To that extent, they can focus more on business rather than throughout the year working on compliances. And one other very important aspect what I personally feel DGPSI will accomplish is, DGPSI will be a compliance requirement in which you will have the CISO, DPO, as well as the CFO and the marketing manager, all of them are involved, because it involves management plus protection. So that I think there is a greater integration of the resources. I feel that in the long run, companies will feel that it becomes something like a superordinate goal for the entire management team, rather than the DPO fighting with CISO or something like that. So that is what we have done. And the DGPSI is being given as an open standard, actually. The standard itself, we want to actually share it. Of course, how it has to be rolled out in terms of templates and other things is something which consultants can customize based on the particular context. But otherwise, the system is considered as an open standard. FDPPI, which I represent, Foundation of Data Protection Professionals in India, which is an NGO created by professionals, okay, who are into data protection for years. That organization will be providing the back-end support in terms of accreditation of auditors, providing certification and capacity building for professionals, so that this DGPSI can be rolled out into a useful industry practice.
I think that's a very good idea. With DGPSI and FDPPI, you will be able to support the companies and people in implementing the Digital Personal Data Protection Bill, as well as any other act that comes around relating to data management, data governance. And the thought process you have in the DGPSI is also very similar to what they are talking about in the UK ICO, because they are saying having a data protection officer is burdensome, or it's also putting the responsibility with somebody who's outside in the business. And you need to put it in the business. So that is a very similar thought process. And that's where I think data protection is going to head into next 10, 20 years. Because you cannot put data protection out of the business. It has to be in the business and with the business. So there has to be a collective responsibility. So I'm very happy to hear that thought. So in essence, if somebody wants to become a member of FDPI, FDPPI, they have to be in India?
Not necessary. It's not necessary. They can be members. We have a few members from the from London, basically, and also the Middle East. So it is open to everybody. It is what we call as Section 8 company. Okay, Section 8 company means it is a not-for-profit company. Secondly, this is not a company where the liabilities are limited by shares. There are no shares in this. It is limited by guarantees. Okay, that way the control of this organization is basically with each member. That is, nobody can say, I will commit 10 lakhs and you give me shares worth of 10 lakhs, I will have the voting powers. It doesn't happen. By entity wise, each person will have only one kind of vote. And it's still a private limited company, which means that we have a limitation on the total number of voting members. So we have, what we have done is we are taking general members in a different category. We call them as basic members, and it is a non-voting membership. We have created a category called supporting members. The supporting members are actually the building blocks of FDPPI, in the sense that FDPPI will execute projects in association with the supporting members. So supporting members will come as a consortium and we work under the brand name of FDPPI, but execution will be with the people, supporting members. We have a revenue sharing arrangement. So instead of having, say, 10 general managers with profit centers, we are having 10 supporting members who will be working as a profit center. So that's the concept which we have tried to develop, because many of our members who come under the supporting member category, they are basically entrepreneurs and business people. Otherwise, we have totally about 400 people who are supporting us today. Not all of them are people who are in the supporting member category. They are just there to consume the services of FDPPI. Even corporate members, they consume the services of FDPPI, like when we do a training or something like that. Supporting members are not consumers. They are actually supporters to FDPPI. So there's a small difference. They execute projects sometimes brought in by them, and they take the assistance of other members in the organization, or I get the inquiry and I ask a couple of people who are suitable for that particular thing whether we can build a consortium for this particular project, and then we try to build a project around that, and they execute it, and there is a pre-agreed arrangement by which a royalty is payable to the FDPPI, and the other income is shared by the participants based on their efforts and kind of a thing. So that is a system which is again unique. I don't think many other organizations have this kind of a setup. I felt that for an NGO of this type, formed by professionals who have essentially a conflicting business themselves, this is a kind of structure which will work. So far it has been working well. We are nearly 5 years old now. 2018 we started. We have completed 5 years. Yeah.
Congratulations. I'm very happy that you are also not only working with the government, but also working with the professionals and also thinking about how do the laws get implemented. So I would say, in essence of time, it has been very enlightening and very enriching to learn about the Indian data protection landscape, the thought process that is going behind in the AI Act, as well as the DGPSI, which I think will help companies in implementing GDPR, the DPPP or DPDP, as we call it, even the AI Act or any other new act that will come up. It will holistically allow for, and maybe will become, let's hope, a standard equivalent of ISO in coming days. And FDPPI will also, I think, grow with the new act and new law. So all the best for whatever you're doing, and keep helping the data protection world as you've been doing. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you liked the show, feel free to share it with a friend and write a review. If you have already done so, thank you so much. And if you did not like the show, don't bother and forget about it. Take care and stay safe. Fit for Privacy helps you to create a culture of privacy and manage risks by creating, defining, and implementing a privacy strategy that includes delivering scenario-based training for your staff. We also help those who are looking to get certified in CIPPE, CIPM, and CIPT through on-demand courses that help you prepare and practice for certification exam. Want to know more? Visit www.fitforprivacy.com. That's www.fit4privacy.com. If you have questions or suggestions, drop an email at hello@fitforprivacy.com. Until next time, goodbye.